Okay. I wanted to speak about something that I haven't spoken before, and probably for good reason, because it's a tough topic. How do we speak to our children about scandal, be it, let's say, rabbis who have been convicted of sexual impropriety, be it leaders on the national, not in the Jewish community, but leadership on a national scale where there's clearly behavior that's not behavior that we would approve of. So my challenge is going to be to talk about this while staying apolitical. Probably impossible, but I'm going to do the best that I can. Okay, I'll start with a quick vignette. When there was an arrest and a conviction of a rabbi who was convicted of sexual impropriety, I won't go into any great detail. There's no reason for me to have to name any names here. It was something that was very much in the press. It was the front page of the local papers. It was the front page of some national papers. And I was invited to spend some time in that community. And I was asked to speak to the members of that shul around the time that he was sent to prison. Not in this community. We're talking about out of town. And I was asked to speak to the kids who went to the main school in town, and to their teachers. So it was three groups that I spent a lot of time with that period of time, including a Shabbos, but also mainly during the week. And I asked the obvious question of the kids when I met with them. I said, how many of you are hearing about what happened with Rabbi of one of the major shuls in town? And all of them raised their hand. Then I asked, how many of you have been reading about it on social media? And they all raised their hand and looked knowingly about what was happening. And I said, okay, can we discuss about what you've gotten in terms of guidance from your teachers, from your Rebbeim? Zero. What is it that you've gotten in terms of discussion with your parents? Nothing. And then when I met with the teachers separately and with the parents separately, it was striking to me that they all agreed with their children. Each assumed that the other group, that either the teachers would talk with the kids about it, and the teachers assumed the parents would talk about it, and the kids were processing it in a total vacuum. And as I spent time, what hit me was how the default setting was, it was so uncomfortable and so difficult, and there was so much discomfort with making values explicit that the kids were left with literally no guidance whatsoever and filling in the vacuum with their own theories and with their own, actually, moral relativism. Just everything that we've been hearing from every speaker until now about what we need to avoid. And I understand that. There's some very interesting research evidence that shows that this is what's happening in terms of us talking to our kids about sexuality in certain neighborhoods, or in general, where the teachers assume that the parents are doing it and feel the parents should be doing it. The parents are clearly uncomfortable doing it and don't do it. And the kids, again, fill in the vacuum with getting their information from each other and online and from places we don't want them getting their information from. So with that as an introduction, let me talk about, let's bring it to what's happening now with President Trump, okay? I know we all have a tremendous debt of hakara hatov to President Trump. I can't imagine anybody here isn't incredibly grateful to him for what he did in terms a lot of courageous kinds of actions, and you know, in terms of putting whatever. I'm going to stay away from the politics. I really am. But here's the question. Forgetting where we stand politically, and I know I could be just as easily talking about the Clintons, and I could just as easily be talking about other political figures. How do we talk to our kids this week about the images of children being incarcerated? You could put the blame wherever you want, but our kids are exposed to strident kinds of positions everywhere they look, so that they hear adults yelling at each other and adults completely certain of their point of view and a lack of perspective taking. And what do we do about that? So that's what I have a very short period of time, I know, till the 1:15 mincha. But if I could just throw off some ideas to you about this and maybe make some recommendations. Number one, what I'm most worried about, and again, and I know this doesn't belong, I know that Democrats are just as much to blame as Republicans. I know that wherever you are politically, both sides are to blame, or all sides are to blame. But here's what our kids are growing up with. They're growing up with very little modeling of calm discussions about perspective taking. Fascinating study shows that if you want to look at mensch making, if you want to look at what gives birth to a mensch, okay? By the way, I can't get into too much trouble. I have tenure. Just want you to know, I have tenure at YU, so I could say things I wouldn't be able to say otherwise. And in this community, I don't think I could get it. Could I get in big trouble in this community? Probably not a little. I probably could. Okay. So here's the study. The study goes, because people are just looking at me. I don't have a sense as to it. Am I getting anybody upset yet? No? We're all okay? Okay, good. Okay. So here's the study. Here's the study. They look at longitudinally large groups of people going into adulthood. What predicts who grows up to be a mensch? The mensch-making question. Probably the most important question that we could have. And as we look at that question, something comes out loud and clear in the data that's totally not expected. That one of the big predictors in whether or not we're raising our children or grandchildren to be decent human beings is how we present the perspective of others to them. When we sit around a table on a Friday night or a Shabbos morning, when we have lunch, when we have Friday night dinner, when we're hanging out with our friends, when we're just schmoozing with everybody, how do we talk about people on the other side? How do we handle the perspectives of people who take views that we violently disagree with? Do we present them with respect and curiosity about where they're coming from, even though we strongly disagree with them? Or do we talk about it from the standpoint of getting curious? Like, you know, if we're having a discussion with our kids, what do you think they might be thinking? Who do you want your child to marry one day? Do you want your child to marry somebody who came from a home that everything was always black and white? Or do you want your child to marry somebody who comes from a home where your future son-in-law or daughter-in-law had training in living with the grays? Because don't we very often live a life that has to handle living in the grays? There's a fascinating Rav Nachman saying that the Torah was basically given in the Yarafel. So he says in the Pasuk, Vayamod ha'am me'rochok, u'moshe nigash el ha'arafel asher sham ha'elokem. And he says, God, this beautiful piece And I have a bunch of other brilliant, brilliant thinking over the ages about the Aruffel. And they all the Mefarshim, they say the same thing. It's in the fog that we're kone wisdom. It's in the fog that we connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And it's in the fog and in the uncertainty that we find wisdom. And that comes into human relations as well. What most worries me about what's happening today is there's very little room for civil discourse. I learned very early on, and I'm sure we all learned shortly after President Trump's election, that wherever you stand, you can't talk about feelings either on either side without facing sometimes very strong pushback from the others. So people have learned to be silent, which is fine. That's all part of keeping shalom. But how are we supposed to react? And I know this comes from both sides. How are we supposed to react to seeing our children being exposed to behavior on either side of deliberately misrepresenting the truth, of bullying and mocking others, be it making fun of somebody who's disabled, be it calling somebody's wife ugly, being failing to take responsibility for misbehavior. And it goes on and on like that. And what are we supposed to do with that? How are we supposed to engage our children in conversation about that without somehow politicizing our homes? So let me share with you a few recommendations and then maybe a couple of stories based on the time. Okay, so here's recommendation number one has to do with the Aruffel. You know, all you have to do is learn Gemara for a little bit of time, let alone Tanakh, and it's filled with respect for uncertainty. How often is there a sugya that ends with kasha? It's a question we don't know. How often do we see people throughout Shas struggling to understand the perspective of others? How often do we see the value of putting ourselves into the head of the other so that the greatness, why do we paskin like Hillel over Shammai? It's because of that ability that Hillel was always able to take the perspective of Shammai as well. And it goes all the way through Shas. And I don't have to talk about this because it's so much part of what our religion is about. Our religion is also about accepting responsibility. It's about the tzadka mimeni. It's about owning up to our mistakes. The very word chet means to miss the mark. So we embrace, in our understanding of Judaism, we embrace the fact that we're going to make mistakes and then we're going to have a do-over. That's what a chet is. A chet is the archers of Sheva bin Yamin always hit the mark, v'lo yachti. So according to that, unlike the Christian view, where it's viewed, chet is viewed as this, a core problem in our personalities and sign of maybe an inherent damage in us, we see it instead as a missing the mark, and now we try harder. We go from threat to challenge. So here's a chain of recommendations about what to do about all of this, okay? Number one is to be understood, first understand. What psychologists who talk about this, most notably a team at Harvard who's written about this, at Harvard Medical School, so they talk about that when your child is, let's say, might be exposed on either side, depending on which network you watch or what you talk about or what newspapers you read. I force myself to read all the papers and it hurts my brain. But because I want to try to take in the different perspectives, it's not so easy to do. But, you know, we have to open ourselves to this. So the first recommendations are to be understood, first understand. Sit with your kid if you think they seem to have been exposed to it. Now, many of our kids may not care about this and may be protected from it, and that's fine. But if you seem to have a kid, and certain kids are exposed to this, you ask them, what have you seen? What have you heard? What do you think about the behavior that you're seeing? How does it make you feel? And then, in a calm and non-judgmental manner, you share with them a little bit about, not about one person being right or another person being wrong. You share with them how you would want them to act with their friends or with family or with other adults in a similar situation. Ask them, what do you think you would do? You bring it into some what ifs. What if you were presented with this? What if you made a mistake? What if you're presented with another kid bullying another kid? So you focus on similar kinds of behaviors they've seen in friends, siblings, parents, and others around them, and you talk about it. And you share with them what you feel. There's something weird going on where we seem to be less certain about our footing in terms of sharing how we feel and sharing our ethics. Kids want to do this. I play a game with my grandchildren called Ethical Dilemma. Now, it sounds like one of those very boring kinds of interactions that is part of the nightmare of having a grandfather who's a psychologist. But when I play Ethical Dilemma with my grandchildren, they love it. Anytime they come to our house for Shabbos, or I just, you know, when I come to this neighborhood to spend Shabbos with them, they just love playing. And they drive me crazy about, saying, Saba, what's the ethical dilemma for today? And because they love being able to think about what would I do in such and such a situation. And it helps them build up the muscle of giving voice to values and thinking, developing an existential theory of mind where they think about the broader issues. And they love it. In a Pesach program that I was speaking in a year or so ago, one of my grandchildren was hanging out with a bunch of friends in the Pesach program's camp. And the girls, as girls will sometimes do, say, let's disappear our counselor. Let's make believe she doesn't exist. We'll make her invisible. Whatever she tells us, we'll ignore. So my granddaughter, who's a pretty normal kid, of course, you know, she's a regular kid, and it just didn't sit right with her. So she excused herself, as these other girls were doing, and she runs to my daughter. She says, Ima, I have an ethical dilemma. And she starts talking out with her how uncomfortable she is with it. So my daughter says, well, what do you think? And they talked it out. And she decided she can't do it. So she runs back to the girl. She says, look, this just isn't right. Let's not do this. And of course, they avoided her the rest of Pesach. But I was very proud of her. We were all very proud of her. That's an example of some of the things we could do. That we could just, I'm not saying you should force discussions on your kids if they're not interested. I'm just saying that to bring it up, it's there anyway. And it may not be there with everybody, but it's there. And if you're talking about it around the Shabbos table, kids definitely hear it. And remember, it's not going to be a process. It's not going to be an event, a one-shot discussion. It's going to be an ongoing process. Let me continue with a couple of other points, as I know we're down to our last few minutes. Number one, I want to talk a little bit about what's the antidote? And it's what every talk that I've heard given today, all the incredible talks, it's just so frustrating not to be able to go to the other, but I understand everything's going to be put online. So we're going to be able to hear everything anyway, even though we haven't been able to. What's the term? I've had massive FOMO the entire morning, okay, of this wonderful program. But let me share with you maybe two stories, a study and two stories as I pull to an end. The study is a study done over three stories. Things are coming into my head, but okay, I can't do it. I just can't do it. How about this? A story on the power of owning up to mistakes, which I think is something that's becoming a lost art. Owning up to our imperfections, which I think is very much one of the antidotes, okay? And interestingly, it's something that in the Menschmaking literature is central. So since this is a memory of my father, we're coming to the very end. This is partly L'Zecher Nishmas, today's wonderful program. I'll share with you a story. Many of us know that he talked about at his 95th birthday, the wonderful program the White Shul had in his honor. In the 95th year of the White Shul, he talked about, as he gets older, wanting to learn how to fail better. Okay? As he got older and wiser, he wanted to master the art of failing better. And that was something that, in the Shiva and the months beyond, I heard many, many stories about that. But I'll share with you just one story of how he brought that into fruition. I was talking to somebody who came to Shiva, and he said he was one of the many Balei Tekiya at the White Shul, blue shofar for the White Shul. And he developed, understandably, it's such a scary thing to do. You know, here you're in a very public place. It's very easy to become self-conscious about it. And it's a major undertaking to be, you know, this is a... you know, the holiest days of the year, and you have to be motzi, a bunch of people, hundreds of, you know, many, many hundreds of people. And he told my father he wasn't going to blow shofar anymore because he was just worried about doing it. So I said, fine, but you know what? Let's start working on a regular basis. Why don't we meet on a regular basis, and let's just start reviewing Hilchos Tekiyas Shofar. He says, just I understand you're not going to blow anymore, but let's just go over Hilchos Tekiyas Shofar. And then ultimately, and they did that for a long time, because, you know, I think he wanted to show him that there may be some more room for imperfection than you think. And he said, look, now that we've done this, I want to give a shiur for the whole shul, or open to the shul on Hilchos Tekiyas Shofar, to teach them to understand better what Hilchos Tekiyas Shofar, and it'll be open to the public. But what I need you for is I need you to come and just demonstrate as many mistakes as you can in blowing shofar. Because the only way they're going to master the halacha is to have you make mistakes on purpose as you blow the shofar. So I'm going to do the whole thing, the tekiyah teruah, tekiyah thing, and you just mess it up. Mess it up in all the ways that we've learned. So he comes, and he just couldn't mess it up. He was too good. He couldn't mess it up. That Rosh Hashanah, he blew shofar. Okay? But the power of growing from our mistakes, the power of embracing them, not running away from them, the power of being able to teach our children that mistakes are an engine of growth. And in the study I spoke about in the first talk this morning after Rabbi Soloveitchik, you know, I talked about some of the work of that Holocaust survivor who looked at the righteous Gentiles. They, too, talked about that one of the things that distinguish the families of righteous Gentiles and made them into moral giants was how were mistakes handled in those homes. If they made a mistake, it was met with calmness. It was met with very clear direction. Hey, I know you're better than this. And that's fine. Let's work on a reparation plan. Let's work on a tshuva process. Let's embrace a tshuva process. And that, I think, is at the heart of what we're talking about here in terms of some of the antidotes. Let me end finally with a study and a story. Okay? Here's the study. It's a study by Dr. Bengston in a book called Families and Faith. He looked at four generations of religious transmission, asking himself a very simple question. if we look at everybody in this room and you want to predict if your great-grandchildren are going to be more or less like you religiously, plus minus one. Like, are your great-grandchildren more or less going to be from Jews living the kind of life that we all live? Is the chain of Masorah going to continue down? And he looked at a very large sample of people for four generations to see what are the active ingredients in your child and your grandchild and your great-great-great-grandchild moving ahead with internalization of our religious values and our way of life and in mensch-making. And it turned out that the most active ingredient wasn't about the content alone. It differs. That differs from people. Some people are drawn to Nach, and other people are drawn to learning Gemara. And as it says in the beautiful thoughts of the Chosev of Lublin, there are many pathways to religious connection. It says some through music, and some through art, and some through singing. I'm sorry, and some through eating, my personal favorite. Some through fasting. And it goes some through nature, some through learning. And he goes on and on. And he says, it doesn't matter. Whatever is your pathway is your pathway. But you want to know what Bengtson found? Ultimately, it was the level of emotional connection between parent and child, between parent and grandchild, between parent and great-grandparent or great-grandchild. That's what it's all about. That if they maintained a sense of warmth of connection, even in the face of rebellion, that's what was the core predictor. And I'll end with a story. Some of you may have heard, but with this, I'll sit down, or we'll daven mincha. Okay? It goes like this. Number of years ago, when I grew up in this area, it was a much less complicated time. We pretty much, most of my class stayed from in different levels of religion, but it was a very low dropout rate. I think the dropout rate is quite a bit higher nowadays from what I could see in certain segments of the community. But there were always two kids who was well known in our cohort. They really rebelled. Here, the one married a non-Jew, the other was involved in all kinds of shady, illegal stuff. They just totally left our way of life, and everybody kind of lost touch with them. We didn't know what happened to them. We know that they were no longer in the New York area. We didn't know what happened to them. So this story is almost going to sound mystical, but it happens to be true. Of all the stories I told today, this one is true. Okay? They're all true. So here's what happens. I go for Shabbos to be a scholar in residence in a shul in California, in the Beverly Hills area. And I stay at one of my old friends from this neighborhood, who had me stay as a guest in his house when I was scholar in residence. And I'm sitting next to him in shul Shabbos morning. And in the back, he points to me, "You see that guy?" And he names one of the two guys. And I see, he's, even though, you know, our kids are already grown up, he's like, his kids are playing in the back of the shul. It's young kids. And he's clearly seems to be part of the shul. I said, "What's he doing here?" I said, "I heard that he totally left." He said, "Oh, yeah, I heard." He said, "I don't know. This guy wasn't at all psychological minded. He was a very well-off guy, a good businessman, but not psychologically minded." He said, "I don't know." I said, "He's here. I don't know." So I run over to him after shul. And I say, Shlomi, what are you doing here? I heard that you were doing well." I said, "I just heard that you were totally not part of our community. What brought you back?" So he said, "You know something?" He said, "It's true. I was married before. She wasn't Jewish." He said, "I was doing all kinds of things I probably shouldn't have been doing." But he says, "I got news for you." He said, "My father never gave up on me. He just stayed connected to me all the way through, and he wore me down. He wore me down. And then, now in this marriage, my kid goes to one of the local day schools, fine." Here's where the story gets mystical. The next day, I was giving a talk in the morning in what used to be Fred Astaire's dance studio. That's now the auditorium of one of the day schools in Beverly Hills. And I'm on the BIMA. The other speaker was Wendy Mogul, well-known parenting expert, the author of The Blessing of a Skin Knee. So she was the main attraction. I was also speaking, and I was giving the second of the talks. And I'm up on this, not very big audience, I'm up on this, like this, but higher. And I think I'm hallucinating, because I see in the back of that room somebody who, even though I hadn't seen him since eighth grade, somebody who I could swear is the second guy. And I think, well, maybe I'm primed to see him. Maybe I'm literally seeing things, but I'm not going to let the opportunity leave. So as second I finish my talk, I jump off the steps. I go running down to the back, and I say, "Chaim, Chaim, is that you?" I figured I'd take a chance. You know, I was from out of town. It didn't matter. And he looks back. He said, "I can't believe you recognize me." And I tell him, I heard that... you know, you were involved, whatever. I heard also you were totally not part of our community. What are you doing here? He says, I have kids in the school. So I came here. It was a parenting program the school sponsored. I said, what happened? And he looked at me and he smiled and he said, my mother never stopped holding my hand. My mother never stopped holding my hand. And I think that's a metaphor for what this is all about, in terms of we're looking for the key to mensch making, the key to ultimately the antidote to some of the stuff that our kids are exposed to, some of the challenges that we have in a world that's gone black and white, is we could model for our children living in the gray. We could model for our children respect for the perspective of others. But perhaps most importantly, antidote number one is embracing them with all their mistakes, and let's never stop holding their hand. Thank you, everybody.